the Seder, and Pesach, and get huge values in the Seder, in the Haggadah. So this way you'll have a full week to prepare. I once heard it said, you know, somebody was preparing for Pesach and said, I'm so sick and tired of cleaning and cleaning and cleaning. And the person answered and said, the rabbi said, you're supposed to prepare for Pesach, not just in cleaning, you're supposed to prepare for Pesach in learning and prepare yourself for becoming a free person. Just if you spend as much time learning Torah and preparing for the Seder as you do in cleaning, that's the right balance. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden people aren't cleaning as much. Okay? By the way, I want to wish everybody a Shana Tova. Tonight is Rosh Hashanah, for those people who don't know. Yes. By the way, look on your faces, you all don't know. Rosh Chodesh Nisan, according to the Mishnah, is Rosh Hashanah. And in many places in Jewish society, it was celebrated more than Rosh Hashanah. We know Rosh Hashanah because of the Chag. But the kings, it was their, and it was many, many things. It was like, so therefore, I want to wish everyone Shana Tova. And if we have time at the end, I'll show you why it's good that this is a new year.
And also, this was the day when the Mishnah was set up, and we just read the whole parsha.
Correct. Well, that's every year. Almost every year. In other words, when they time it, that the Mishkan is finished, and then usually comes Nisan. Okay. Now, the topic tonight is a very strange topic for Jewish values, because on the one hand, you know, this is not a philosophy course. On the other hand, I found something when I taught students, and I taught you, and I don't want to embarrass anybody, but when I would teach students who were here after 12 years, and sometimes even at the end, when I substituted in June, and I would ask them, I said, next year in three months, you're going to be the first time in a non-Jewish environment. The person sitting next to you is not going to be Jewish, and you're going to try to keep the mitzvot, and they're going to ask them, why do you keep the mitzvot? Why do you keep the Torah? And you can't do a 45-minute talk. You have to answer them in 2 minutes. What would you say? And 99%, almost all, never take an answer after 13 years of learning Torah intensively, supposedly. If I said the same thing for all of us, not that it hasn't happened, maybe it has, but not that it will happen, but there you have to be prepared. If somebody says to you, how do you know there's a God? Well, why do you believe in God? And after all your learning and thinking and observing, etc., you say, I don't know. That's a Chilul Hashem. Not because it's Chilul Hashem you intended, but this guy said, he puts in 1,000 hours a year, or 10,000 hours a year in his Judaism, and he doesn't even know why. You understand? So therefore, there is a phrase in Pirkei Avot that says, Da ma shetashiv la'apikoros. You have to know how to answer a non-believer. Right? And the Chazal say, Da'ma shetashiv la'apikores shebecha. You have to answer the non-believer that's inside you before you can talk to somebody else. Now, I'm not going to embarrass anybody by saying, listen, why do you believe in God? Because first of all, that's the end of the lesson. Because everybody had their own opinion. And then we finish. You know? And it's okay, by the way, when you're living in a totally Jewish society, you don't have to deal with this issue. Okay, you want to deal with the issue, you don't, right? But you're living in a society of people who don't believe in God, or even Jews who don't believe in God, and by the way, they're just as much Jewish as you and me, but they ask you, you feel a little embarrassed not to know how to answer. So, and I'm sure many of you answer, and I'm sure for some of you I'm repeating things you already know, but I want to do it in an orderly way.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I think it was Dennis Prager who said, I can't prove that there's a God, but I can't prove that there's none. So if I'm in doubt, I better go with the
Well, Dennis, a God. Dennis is a, I won't say friend, but I've met him many few times, and he stole that from Pascal, the guy who invented the computer, or the beginning of the computer, as we will see. That's a very good point. That's one of the arguments. We'll come back to that in a few minutes.
I actually have another
comment. Yes.
Where I had the question somebody asked me recently of, why are you religious?
Okay, we're going to get to that too.
Which also basically is. And
you,
I
you
said.
You came in here for God, but we're going to leave here for Torah.
Okay.
You'll see we're going to get to that too. And I think I didn't give that many sources, but the sources that I have are Kedai to have. So first of all, let's talk about belief in God. Without going into if it's a mitzvah or not a mitzvah to believe in God, we'll talk about that. First, let's give an air question. Can we prove that God exists? That's the first question.
Can we prove
that God exists?
Yes.
Yes or no?
No.
I think we can provide evidence. I don't know what we can provide.
Okay, very good word, evidence. We're going to come back to that. And I'm going to say to you, we can't prove God exists. And you can't prove God doesn't exist, like you said. Because, by very definition, when you say proof, either it has to be totally logical, not being hypothetical. When you say proof in the 21st century, it means scientific proof.
Tangible.
Scientific proof
tangible.
Is based only on anything that's in the physical world, right?
Yeah.
Correct? That's the definition of science. Anything in the physical universe, we can prove that it exists, it doesn't exist, or how it exists and define it, etc. But if you're talking about something that doesn't exist in the physical world, you can't prove it, right? Because you can't weigh it, you can't measure it, you can't, we know it. There are many things, by the way, that exist. Now more and more the brain can, we can sort of prove it from the brain a little bit, but there are many concepts, like the concept of love, right? It exists, but it's very hard to prove what exactly it is. But certainly God, that by definition does not have a body and does not have, I'm not talking about any other religion, I'm talking about Jewish religion, does not have a body, does not have any physicality, we have no way of proving or disproving something that is only a concept. Everybody understand that? Okay. So, but then what are we doing here? Okay? So we can't prove it. And by the way, that's a very good thing. Why is that a very good thing from a Jewish perspective? If we could prove from a Jewish perspective, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that God existed, how would that change us?
No bechira.
So there's no bechira, so we keep the Torah. It would be tremendous change. Let's just say, okay, every time, imagine a world where every time God exists, okay? We all see God from whatever perspective, etc. It's very obvious. And every time you do something bad, there's a little a man with a pitchfork that comes to you over here and makes and gives you a shock. And every time you do, that's every time you do an aveira, a sin. And every time you do a mitzvah, there's a little man with wings that will push the pleasure centers in your brain. Okay? Why would that change our lives? There's no challenge anymore. We would only do good things.
Not
unless we're just too weak. Just too weak. Right? Because if we assume that the bigger shock for the worse sin, let's say, whatever, you get a bigger shock, whatever. Why not necessarily?
Because plenty of people, you know, do what they do because they do what they do.
Okay. Very few people.
It doesn't matter what they believe, it doesn't matter what they know.
Very few people, it's very interesting. I asked this question in one of the chapters I dealt with. Very few people, while they're doing something wrong, while they're doing it, think it's wrong. They don't think about it, but they justify it somehow, rationalize. Okay? Even though religious people know there's a God watching them, they still sin. How is that possible? Because of what you said. Because God wants to ensure so much that there's free will in the world, He's willing to do so many things that are hurtful, painful. For example, if every time the Nazis wanted to kill Jews and shot at Jews, He would make their guns, jam.
Or backfire.
Right?
Backfire.
Because he doesn't want to kill innocent Jews.
Have it backfire.
That would destroy free will. Right? If any time anything bad in the world was about to happen, God stepped in, we wouldn't have free will. And free will is the most important thing. Without free will, we can't exist. Because then we don't get reward, we don't get punishment. It's not a mitzvah anymore. It's not a. We have to do it. There wouldn't be an idea of doing evil because we are afraid to do bad. Not because we think intellectually it's bad. So it's very good that there's always some doubt in our mind. Rabbi Norman Lamb, who passed away about a year and a half ago, wrote a book called Faith and Doubt. And he showed that doubt is part of faith. That if we were 100% sure that every single thing that we did, that God was watching us every single minute, then our free will would be compromised. So therefore, in order that we should have free will, and that we get rewarded for coming to a shiur tonight, instead of doing something that is not quite as Jewish or Torah-dic, that's part of the game, part of the structure, okay? So it's very good that there is no absolute proof that there is enough, okay? Again, if that's true, what are we doing here? So, there is a sharp line between knowing and believing, okay? And proving, I would go one step further, which means the following. If we believe that there's a God, we're reasonably sure, but we can't prove it 100%, that's very different saying, I'm on the 50-50 line, I'm not sure. Okay? Obviously. So, on the one hand, there's an element of belief, but there's also an element of trying to know. The very, very first halakha, very first halakha of the Rambam in the first Siman, and the first book of the 14 books of halakha, he writes in source number one, Leida Sheyesham Eloha. We are obligated to try to understand how there is a God. The word Leida, okay? Try to understand, which means this class today. Try to understand intellectually how there could be a God. And he goes on to say, Yesod HaYesodot, the foundation of foundations, the Amun HaChachmot, and the, again, bedrock of wisdom, Leida Sheyesham Matsui Rishon, to know that there is a first, what he called that in Aristotelian terms, a first primary mover, a first cause. Shehu Mamsikol HaNimtzah, from him, from God comes everything. Okay? Mishamayim Ba'aretz, from the seas and the, from the heavens and the earth, Umashe Beinam and everything in between, Lamsu Elamei Amitat HaNimtzah. Everything comes from him, from nothing. On the other hand, the Rambam stops his second book, actually this is his first book, the first book of Mitzvot, where he describes Mitzvot, he uses a totally different verb. What's the verb? Mitzvat, Mitzvah Rishona, the first Mitzvah, two. Hi Yatzivui, Asher Tzivanu Leha'amin. To believe, O Elokut, Shena'amin, Sheyesham, to believe that there is a God, Allah Masava, Upoel, Cholim Tzot. Same kind of ideas. So he says there's an obligation for all of us to have both. Why? Obviously, you can't prove it 100%, so knowledge is not going to be enough. On the other hand, saying you only believe, and there's two kinds of belief. There's a belief, if you go to Prager's book, I think he talks about that. The first book that Dennis Prager and Joe Talishkin wrote, Nine Questions People Ask About Judaism, they spent a year, they grew up in a Jewish, in a religious homes, and they said, we're going to spend a year going around the world and going to every religion there is and asking them the same questions. And then we're going to put it up and compare it to Judaism. And that's what they did. And after they came back, they realized that Judaism wins, right? Judaism is the best religion. And they talk a little bit about there's an element of belief and there's an element of knowing. So belief is easy if you're in the shtetl and everybody believes and your whole chevra believes. But when you're in the 21st century, and the children and everybody is so convinced by science, facts, everything that quote they call facts, it's very hard to say my belief is stronger than your facts. Because nobody be saying, what are you, in the 15th century, are you nuts? You gotta believe facts, okay? And that's a different story. We talk about, I don't know, do science and religion yet? I don't remember. We didn't, I don't know. Anyway, it's not that, that's not so important. What is important is, what does it mean to know if we can't prove that God exists? So what I'm proposing, you, who said evidence? Nelson said evidence. What I'm proposing tonight is to go through different arguments that have been said throughout the centuries, some of them not Jewish, to show you that if we have to do through logical arguments, I like the word arguments, through logical arguments, it's more logical to believe in a God than not to believe in a God. It's much more difficult to live in a world that doesn't believe in God. Okay, and that's what I want to show you tonight. Okay, everybody understand? Okay, so the first argument is the philosophical argument. If anybody is interested, it's called the cosmological argument. What's the cosmological argument? He says, logically, there can only be three explanations how the world came to be. What are the three possibilities?
The Big Bang.
The Big Bang. What else?
Hashem.
God.
Well, that could be God. And also, but okay, what else?
And
it's all a figment of our imagination.
We don't really exist. We're in the Matrix.
I just wrote
a book. I'm coming out in June. I actually have a chapter in the book called "Which Is the Real World? Is the Matrix True?" Okay,
I
and you'll see there are many sources that say yes. So we're not really in this world right now.
This is all a dream.
This is all a manifestation of other worlds, but that's not the cosmological argument. What's the cosmological argument? What are the three possibilities?
It always existed.
It always existed.
But then what
it
happened
before? It was caused
before?
By something, or it came about randomly. Okay? Now, Big Bang, the scientists will probably say it came about randomly, but not everybody. But, okay, those are the only three possibilities, correct? Yes, no?
Yeah.
Okay. Everything else in the physical world, everything, came about because something caused it. Correct? Okay? This shtender, somebody had to say, listen, I'm going to make a shtender, and eventually I'm going to sell it to the Afrodar Shul, and even though it squeaks like crazy, they'll buy it because they need shtenders. Okay? And everything in this room, and everything outside, and everything we know comes from something else. Nothing sprouted by itself. They try to prove that in the Middle Ages, but everything comes from something else, correct? So if that is true, then it's more logical to say that the world itself, the universe itself, comes from something else than it does to say it happened by itself.
Except for light.
Except for light. Light comes from something else also.
No, the current says it's spontaneously generated.
I don't know. The Chumash I have says by he or. God created the light. I don't know the Gemara, but I'm there. The
no,
Chumash
light.
Light.
Kinim.
Light. Oh, okay.
Kinim.
Spontaneous generation. By the way, there are many statements in the Gemara that not taken seriously because science has shown that, you know, we don't do bloodletting today, even though it was very popular
actually,
in time of the Gemara.
They do. They use leeches.
Leeches are still
helpful.
That's not bloodletting. Okay, whatever.
Yeah.
The point is that just because there's a Gemara that says something doesn't mean that it's normative Judaism today. Okay? So let's take away lice and let's put in light. Some light. The cosmological argument says that there has to be a cause of everything in the world. Therefore, it's logical that the universe itself is caused by something. This happens to be, in our generation, the popular view of science as well. What do they say? They say that in science, as you said before, that all of a sudden, how it happened, why it happened, etc. But in 1 second, there was a Big Bang. And from that came the entire universe as we know it today. Billions and billions, etc., of stars and galaxies and all kinds of things. Correct? Mm-hmm. So what the first argument, cosmological argument, says, it's more logical to say if there was a Big Bang, that there was a Big Banger, rather than say it happened by itself. Okay? And therefore, we believe that the Big Bang. you're going to say, who created the Big Bang or who created God? Right? That's not on the table because, first of all, the Big Banger is not the physical world. So it's not the same as everything else we're talking about. It's a different concept completely, a philosophical idea of God not in the physical world doesn't have to have something that caused it to come into existence because we're talking about the physical world. So anything in the physical world had a cause. God, we don't believe, had a cause, but it's not the same thing. It's apples and oranges. And therefore, the cosmological argument says that it's more logical to say that there was something that caused the Big Bang than that it happened by itself. And by the way, science, who doesn't claim it was God, by the way, if you're interested in this in deep, much greater depth, there's a guy named, it's on the Eish HaTorah website, Gerald Schroeder, who talks about how scientifically, if you know anything about the science of the universe, it's more logical to see, he shows how, not only the psukim, but how God is much more logical from a scientific perspective. He lost me somewhere about 45 minutes in, but it's very, very convincing. So that's the first argument. Okay? Second argument is very interesting. It says, imagine that, it's called a teleological argument, if you're interested. Okay? Imagine if you were, after a great avalanche happened in a place that was remote, nobody lived. Okay? And you went to this place just to check it out. And then you see 8 boulders, right? Big boulders on the sand. There's a tremendous ocean and everything, avalanche came and you're checking it out. And the boulders are together, 3, 3, and 2, that spell an H. You say, that's interesting. And you walk another 60 feet exactly, and you see other boulders. And all of a sudden, these 8 boulders spell out, it has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, an E. Okay? And then you walk another 60 feet, and it's an L. And another 60 feet, another L. Another 60 feet, and a
O.
O. Now, after the first one, you might say, you know, boy, that's a coincidence. But boy, isn't that an interesting coincidence? After the fifth one, you're not going to say it's coincidence anymore, or are you?
No.
Okay? The teleological argument is exactly that. There are so many unbelievable coincidences in our world that make it better, logical, workable, that it is much more logical to say this was caused by something intelligent that wanted it to be this way, then that it's all by accident. Okay? You understand what that means? Okay.
Teleological?
I'm sorry?
Teleological.
Teleological. And I could continue, you know, the argument, and then you keep going, and it says, same thing, have a nice day, etc. The more it had it, the more you say it's impossible that it's accidental. Okay? I'm going to give you something here. I'm just going to read it because it's just an unbelievable facts that keep us relatively comfortable right here, right now. The Earth's size is perfect for life to exist. The Earth's dimensions and the corresponding gravity hold a thin layer of mostly nitrogen and oxygen gases, extending only about 50 miles above the Earth's surface. If Earth was any smaller, an atmosphere would be impossible, like the situation in Mercury. And if it was larger, an atmosphere would be free of hydrogen, like Jupiter's atmosphere, and only Jupiter's atmosphere. Earth is the only known planet equipped with the atmosphere of the right mixture of gases to sustain plant, animal, and human life. Go further. The Earth is located exactly the right distance from the Sun. Consider the temperature swings in the Earth are about only from minus 30, Siberia minus 40, to about 120 degrees Fahrenheit. If the Earth were any further away from the Sun, right, we would all freeze. Any closer, we'd all burn up. Even a fractional variance in the Earth's position of the sun would make life impossible. For example, the Earth remains a perfect distance from the sun while it rotates around the sun at a speed of nearly 67,000 miles per hour. If we went any faster, we would be blown off the world, off the Earth. If we went slow, it wouldn't work. And it also only works when you have the gravitational pull of the moon, or else it wouldn't work perfectly. Okay? It's also rotating on its axis, allowing the entire surface of the Earth to be properly warmed and cooled every day. It is far more logical to say that these were all created intentionally in order to allow life to thrive, rather than conclude that these details were miracles, accidents of time. And with all the explorations, and now they found 10,000 potential planets that might have life, etc., based on that, we haven't found anything so far. I'm not, even if we do, I'm not going to say that therefore that we're... I mean, similarly, to me it's fascinating. Water is colorless, it's odorless, without taste, and yet no living thing can survive without it. Plants, animals, human beings consist mostly of water. Okay? Why? If water doesn't keep coming out of our bodies at all times, whether, you know, our ears or any other orifices, is also amazing. Two-thirds of the human body is water. The characteristics of water are uniquely suited to life. It has an unusually high boiling point and a low freezing point. Water allows us to live in an environment of fluctuating temperatures while keeping our bodies at a steady 98.6 Fahrenheit degrees. Water is a universal solvent. This property means that thousands of chemicals, minerals, and nutrients can be carried through our bodies and into the smallest blood vessels. Water is also chemically neutral. Without affecting the makeup of the substances it carries. Water enables food, medicines, and minerals to be absorbed and used by the body. And it goes on and on. You understand what I'm saying. The tallest trees, everything, yes.
Another interesting, water is the only substance that when it freezes, instead of getting smaller, gets larger.
Right, that's also important, right.
And therefore, otherwise it would have, yeah, it stays on the surface as opposed to going, otherwise right. Bodies of water that froze would freeze.
Rabbi Wein wrote a book called Don't Eat Green Bananas. And he, don't eat green bananas. And consider the banana. When it is green and unripe, the color tells humans that it's unsafe, unhealthy, or not tasty to eat. It is difficult to pick a single banana off the branch of the bunch at this point, and it is likewise almost impossible to peel. If one eats it at that point, he will get a stomach ache. The banana knows that humans will be able to detect color change, and that their hands can detach one banana from the bunch. Okay, it can go on and on and on and on. This is the teleological argument. Now, the argument, on the other hand, is 1 billion monkeys typing at 1 billion typewriters. Anybody know what a typewriter is? Right? Can produce Shakespeare, right? It was trial and error, trial and error, trial and error, trial and error, and that's how we got to where we are today. It's more logical the other way around. Everything in this world is accidental. Very, very hard. We see the an ecological system working together. It suggests that there's somebody who created that system, as opposed to, oh, everybody just got along. All right? So that's the second argument, cosmological, theological. Third argument is what Susan mentioned, what Dennis Prager mentioned. It's called Pascal's Wager. This is not really an argument. This is just a safe bet. He says, Pascal, again, he really invented the computer. You can look, he was a tremendous theologian, but he also invented the idea that numbers could be manipulated, and then eventually cards and computer. He said, there are two possibilities. Either there is God, or there isn't God, or from our perspective, either there's God in the Torah, or there isn't God, okay? He said, let's take two different lives. If you want to live a Torah lifestyle, so what does that mean? You get up every morning and you say Moda Ani, and you basically follow the rituals, but you also live a very good life, because part of living the Torah is giving tzedakah, helping old people, respecting your parents. You're a pretty good person, correct? That's one possibility. Another possibility is you have no responsibility, you do whatever you want, And very soon, I believe, sometimes people take till they're 60, some people take till they're 40, some people take less, some people never find that out. There was a movie called Wall Street, right? Greed is good. The person who has the most toys at the end wins. All life is about having fun and getting more than the other guy. But most people who have done this found it's not ultimately satisfying, okay? But let's just say that though, these are the two possibilities, having a fun, a life of fun, and even if some of that fun means helping other people, etc. So let's just say you live a total life, and after 120 years, you get to the thing, and there are no pearly gates, and there's no God, there's no anything. So you still lived a pretty good life, and you wasted, I don't know, maybe 20, 30 years out of your 80, 120 years putting on these straps every morning. Okay. But and there's nothing there afterwards.
It's good for
but what about the opposite?
What?
It's good for your blood pressure.
Right. What about the opposite? Supposing you don't believe in God and you don't keep anything, and then you get after 120 years, and the Kodesh Baruch Hu says,
what
have you got to show for yourself? Here's the videotape of your life. In eternity, you're not going to be in the best place. Okay? So Pascal's wager says it's better to live a life, he doesn't say Torah, a life of Torah, and to quote, waste some of it, but live a pretty good life, than to live a life as if God doesn't exist, and then find out that he exists and there is judgment. And therefore, he says it's more logical or it's a safer bet. That's why he called it Pascal's wager. All right. That appeals to some people, doesn't appeal to other people. Fourth argument, the moral argument. If we say there's no God, then Nazi Germany is right. They made laws in Nazi Germany that it's okay to kill Jews because Jews are causing the physical and moral detriment to our society. Who is to say they're wrong? Everybody understand that? In other words, if every society decides for themselves and there's nothing above all the societies to tell you what's right and wrong, then each society can decide. And who are you to tell me I'm wrong? If I want to kill you, I can kill you. If my government says it's okay, fine. Correct? And therefore, the moral argument says there has to be a God for there to be certain principles and certain guidelines for all human beings. Okay? This was, without saying the word God, was basically decided by all the countries in the world in 1946. There was the Nuremberg trials, and the Nuremberg trials, the judges who knew laws better than anybody else were the ones that violated the most and were put on trial, among others. The Nuremberg trial said, but I was only keeping the law. I was only following the orders. And the Nuremberg said, but there are certain rules, certain laws, certain principles, certain morality, which you have to say, no, I'm not going to follow the law. Right? How can they say that? The only way you can say that is there are certain principles beyond that we all agree on. Right? And, you know, the United Nations amplified this, etc. So the moral argument is, there are certain principles above all what we can agree on, only if there's a God. Because if there's no God, then I get up and say, in my world, it's okay to do anything I want. Okay? That's the moral argument. Okay. Next one I call this, I don't know what it's really called in the real world, is the beauty argument. If you don't believe in God, there's no concept of beauty. Why? It's all accidental. The sunset is accidental. Don't say it's beautiful, because it's only a bunch of colors coming together at the same time. You know, you can't say it's beautiful. Beautiful is already saying that somebody intended for you to enjoy it. How can you enjoy it? Because it's not intended. Any beauty in the world. Now, everybody I see looking in their own experiences what means beauty in the world, the nature, is, by the way, if you ever haven't seen it yet, there's a few very, very good videos. This guy, Richard Attenborough, has made these videos now with cameras and the ability to go all over and the ability of cameras to zoom in, you know, a mile or two to be, not to interfere, made some of these videos of different parts of the world, whether it's ice or whether it's underneath the world in the water or how animals, behave. For example, this became a popular one a few years ago, March of the Penguins, mm-hmm. where the fathers were basically the ones that saved the society, because they took the penguins when the kids went so the mother could get more fat, or the other way around, I don't know, whatever it was. It was unbelievable how they marched in the free. So all that's not amazing. All that just happened to be. Okay? You have to say that unless there's a purpose, or something that did it to make us amazed. Now, I agree with you that things alive can't appreciate beauty except man. You don't have a monkey going, yeah, that's pretty beautiful, that's pretty special, right? Nobody, we have a special ability to analyze our past, analyze our present, and look at beauty in the world. And that's part of what the Torah says, why the focus of creation was man, because we have certain capabilities that animals don't. Anyway, so that's the beauty argument, okay? The other thing also, I like to use this argument, it's like it's following. Similar to a man who comes into a friend's home and sees a beautiful painting, say, of nature just completed. The man asks, who painted this magnificent work? The friend answers that he put the canvas on the floor, took out different paints, and threw it randomly in the air, and this is what happened.
Jackson Pollock.
Okay? But Jackson Pollock, we know he did that, okay? And it doesn't look beautiful to the eye unless you know how to, it's like you had to study to understand how it's beautiful, right? The guest reacts and says, this is impossible, that's absurd. The non-believer who denies God's existence essentially agrees that the painting, the world, came about randomly, and all beauty is random, okay? So therefore, it's more logical to say that beauty in the world is real, and it was intended to be, okay? By the way, I found something very interesting. In the real world, and we talked about beauty, in the real world, in the natural world, we can have many things that we all agree is beautiful. And we all agree is ugly, by the way, also. In the human world, even if you draw the same thing, not everybody agrees. In other words, you have a beautiful sunset in Ashkelon, and everybody says, wow, beautiful. Somebody draws that, well, it's not exactly, not so nice, it's not exactly the same. You know, something is about the nature itself. Okay, so that's the beauty argument. How much time we got? Okay, we're gonna do okay. Okay, this one is, I suggest that, I don't know when we're gonna do it, but we have a session on what's the purpose of life, but I call this the meaning of life argument, right? If God does not exist, then what are we doing here? What's our purpose for being alive? We are no different than what I call a dandelion. You know what dandelion is? Mm-hmm. In America, I don't see dandelions in Israel. This is the part that all the people who have grass in America cut off because it takes away from the green. Their dandelions grow and they're yellow on top. And they very easily, the flowers dissipate, right? We're no different than a dandelion or a flower that comes into being in the world. And a flower may be a few days. For us, it may be 100 years. But what's the purpose? When we're finished. Another one comes along. What are we doing here? If we have, yes.
The species, the survival of the human beings.
If it's survival of the fittest, then we all...
No. Survival of our species.
First of all, the Rambam interestingly says that's the purpose of the animal, that the species should survive.
Yeah.
But if you say that survival of species, so that, believe me, if I lock the door right now and make sure nobody ever came back into this door, which is not going to happen, okay, tomorrow chakras, but, and nobody in this room ever left, and everybody in this room, including me, didn't continue to exist. We all died. Our species would be just fine, right? You and I don't make the species any better.
Okay.
Better because of what we in particular do. I don't think so, do we?
The macro, not the micro.
Okay, so the macro. So why do we need, at the beginning of the 1900, I think there were 1 billion people in the world. Now there are 8 billion people in the world. We certainly don't need 8 billion people in order to make a best species. Okay? Or let's kill everybody who's not a scientist. We'll make the species better. Right? Let's get, you know, if we have math, you know, it wasn't Maslow, it was Malthus. He said, in every generation, there are always people who predict that they're never going to be able to have enough food for the amount of people in the world, which never been proven, never will happen. But
Ehrlich.
What?
Ehrlich. There's a debate.
Yeah, Ehrlich. True. Yeah. But you know what? I'm going to tell you guys a secret.
He loved it.
That I realized that I'm the first person to tell you this, but maybe you'll hear it by the end of your lives. Within 50 years, all food, not 50, maybe 100 years, all food will be grown in the laboratory. If we can duplicate meat, we can duplicate bread, you can duplicate, you won't need any fields anymore. You will have unending supply of food. Once you can make it in the laboratory, it'll change everything, right? Okay, anyway, getting back to our...
Does that mean we can have steak every night?
You can have steak every night now.
You can have a cheeseburger.
Why can't you have steak every night now?
I can't afford it.
Okay. Because you're a rabbi, it's your problem. Okay? Anyway, but the point is that it can't be that to make the species better, because then you don't need 8 billion people to make the species better. Right? And what are you doing to make the species better? Right? It's hard to say. So what's my purpose here? Help people? Maybe. But why? For what purpose? Right? Once HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us a mission, and within that big mission, each of us has an individual mission, whether it's to be Mekad Hashem Shemayim, and to make the world a better place, and to make the, etc., to make perfection and bring Mashiach, etc. We have a direction. We know where we're going. And that's something that only God can say. Because if not, then, you know, everybody chooses. And after a while, everybody gets burned out because they don't feel that they're really contributing, doing the important things, whatever that is. So the meaning of life argument means if there's no God, there's no purpose to our lives. You can invent purposes, and there's nothing wrong with feeling good, helping people, even if you don't believe in God. And that's not the point. But the point is that you don't know, or you don't feel that, you know, I was put here for a purpose. Okay? So that's the meaning of life argument. Now, this is a very interesting argument. I'll tell you, I forgot which emperor. It was an emperor of Germany that said, that was a good way of introducing what I wanted to do before. It was an emperor of Germany, I think it was an emperor of Germany, of 200 years ago, who said to one of his court philosophers or whatever, prove to me there's a God. But prove to me there's a God in two words. And he said, the Jews. Okay? That goes back to what we talked about in astrology, that the Ein Mazal Yisrael, right? The Jews defy every rule of a people, in every way, right? Except that they argue with each other. I think every people does that. But think about it. If you think about every single people, do I have the Mark Twain thing here? Yeah, I think I have it, yeah. Every single people in the world. No, I don't. I'm not on the thing here. Okay. by the way, I didn't go to the sources because I didn't get there for a reason. And that's source number 3 was the Rambam saying you should try to find, you know, try to understand how why there is a God. Okay. Anyway, the Jews defy. If you take away a religion from any religion, its central focus, whatever that focus is, the religion can't survive. They took away our central focus, which was the base on Mikdash, and we survived. We changed it to Torah learning, or to the Torah, and that kept us alive. You take away any people from its land, within a few generations, finished. And even when people are on their land, every great nation, every great empire that existed, went up, ruled the world, right? Any people from England here? 100 years ago, England, right? The sun never set on the English Empire, etc., etc., right? You ruled the world, right? For many, many years. Who could have imagined that in 2023, England, you know, Bokoshi, you know, where they are now after Brexit. But that's, you know, ups and downs. And America, you know, we're starting to see America is not always going to be the number one after we thought that was after the collapse of the Soviet Union. The only exception to this rule is the Jews. We've been able to survive and thrive despite the fact that we've been in diaspora, despite the fact that we've been a minority, despite the fact. Doesn't make any sense. Correct? Okay? And everything about Jewish life doesn't really make sense. This is the famous Mark Twain quote. And it's in source number 4 in case you want to look it up yourself. If the statistics are right, the Jews constitute but 1% of the human race. We're that much less than that now. One third of 1% of the human race. It's suggested by a nebulous dim puff of stardust lost in the blaze of the Milky Way. Properly, the Jew ought to hardly be heard of. But he is heard of, has always been heard of. He is as prominent on the planet as any other people, and his commercial importance is extravagantly out of proportion to the smallness of his bulk. His contributions to the world list of great names in literature, this is in 1898, by the way, before Nobel Prizes, etc. Science, art, music, finance, medicine, and abstruse learning are also way out of proportion to the weakness of his numbers. He has made a marvelous fight in this world, in all the ages, and has done it with the hands tied behind him. He could be vain of himself and be excused for it. The Egyptian, the Babylonian, and the Persian rose filled the planet with sound and splendor, then faded to dream stuff and passed away. The Greek and Romans followed, made a vast noise, and they are gone. Other people have sprung up, and they held their torch high for a time, but it burned out, and they sit in twilight now or have vanished. The Jews saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he is always exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert mind and aggressive mind. All things are mortal, but the Jew, all other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality? I'm going to share with you two pieces, and then we got to get going. We don't realize how much we defy the odds by sitting here in Ashkelon today in 2023. There was another country that was created in 1948. Two other countries. Anybody know?
India, Pakistan.
You look in India, Pakistan. They have all the numbers on us. But if you look at everything else about their countries, my son was just there. He says half of India did not have electricity till the last year or two. He made his point, this guy Modi, to give them electricity. He says they didn't have outhouses. He says, you know, talking about indoor plumbing that we, you know, that's number one. Number two, okay, so you compare Israel today, right? The only people who don't have indoor plumbing in Israel are the Bedouins who don't want indoor plumbing and prefer to be where they are right now, for whatever reason, okay? So, and there's no starvation in Israel. Anybody wants to eat has a place to eat. So it's just a different country 75 years later. Not only that, this is what blows my mind. If you look how we continue to defy everything. If you look at the last year, you'd say, good year for Israel, not such a good year. Lots of good years. Arabs killed a lot of Jews on the streets, right? Elections, you remember how bitter they were. The judicial things going on. Terrible year, okay? And I wrote this on the webpage, and of course CNN did not take notice of it. came out with the happiness index 2 days ago. Okay, so Israel, who has never had a moment of peace in its existence, was always number 11, then last year got to number 9, happiest nation in the world.
4.
Right? But happiest nation in the world, number 11. How can you be happy when you know people 40 miles from here, 10 miles from here, want to kill you? And how could you be happy when cottage cheese is more expensive than all of Europe? And how could you be happy when blah, 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 blah. You complain, 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 complain. And that's okay. And I say we complain, but we're really happy people. But to jump from 9 to 4 in the world in a year that we just had defies all logic. And that's what I'm saying. Jewish people defy all logic. Why are we happy? I have my theories, and that we don't have time for.
Do you have a minute?
No, not that one. I want to get into it. We don't have time. Gotta get going. Because I want to prove to you the Torah thing. Okay, last argument, two arguments, and then we get to the Torah. Okay, I'm going to try to do it quickly. Second to last argument is evil versus everything else in argument. This is Milton Steinberg, who was a conservative rabbi. He said this in the 1950s. He says, for the people who believe in God, you have to understand one very, very hard thing to understand. How can God allow good people to suffer and evil people to prosper? Right? So I think Rallo Theodicy. He says, but if you don't believe in God, you have to explain everything else. It's easier for me to go into that. By the way, I'll have a chapter on that too in the next book with different arguments why that happens. It's like free will. But so that's his argument. The last argument, which is we don't really appreciate, is Rabbi Yehuda Halevi said this in the 12th century. Very interesting. He said, if you think about every astrological time that we have during the calendar, during the year, everything is tied to something physical in the world, in astronomy. The month, tied to the moon. 360, 155 days, tied to
sun.
Take the rotation sun. Around, revolution around the sun. 24 hours tied to
the moon.
The revolution, the rotation, 24 hours. There's only one thing that's not tied to anything.
Shabbat.
Not Shabbat, but 7 days. Where is there a 7-day week in astronomy? There are 30 days. 30 days could be 2 twice 15. It could be four times, it could be 9 times 7. I'm sorry, 9 times, what would be 9 times 7? I mean, 9 times...
3.3,
whatever.
Yeah.
The point is that there's no 7-day concept in astronomy, and yet every country in the world, this I'm not getting into the Jewish stuff now, every country in the world has a 7-day week, bar none. There are a few African ones that tried 10-day week. I looked this up, and in Japan they tried a 9-day week once or twice, but they all have seven. Where did they come from? So Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says that obviously at one point the whole world believed that there was a 7-day week because it reminds them of Shabbat, and they said 7-day week is a concept that God created when He created the world, but it's not astronomical at all. So therefore, that is the fact that the whole world keeps a 7-day week in some way ties to the Jewish concept of creation.
Yeah.
Okay, wow. Even in the places that never heard of Jews, they have a 7-day week. How is that possible? Okay.
Because they take it from the Christian Bible.
In the next 4 minutes, 5 minutes, we're going to do some sources, if it's okay with you. Okay, now, so far we've talked about how how it makes more sense that God created the world than not. I think I could draw 10 arguments. Now I'm going to show you how it makes more sense that the Torah had to be written by God rather than a human being. I will prove to you that it couldn't have been written by a human being. First example, which again, don't use it by 2023 terms. Remember, when the Torah was written, everything was an agrarian society.
What's okay? Agrarian?
Agrarian means agriculture.
Agrarian, okay.
So in the Torah, it says, in the 6 years, you grow your crops. In the 7 years, seventh year, you stop growing your crops. What happens in the 8th year if you don't grow your crops? People starve. Okay? So if God did not write the Torah, what idiot would write in the Torah, don't plant in the 7th year, and I guarantee you that you'll have enough in the 8th year. That's what it says in source number 6. Okay? The Kuzari is in source number 5 that we talked about before with the 7th day week. Sheishanim tizra sadecha, sheishanim tzmor kamecha, tzata tzuatav, shanash, v'yit shabbat tzavatoni yelar aretz. You have a year of fallow, a Shabbat for the land, And then it says, again, if you saw 6, 7, 8, you look at the eye afterwards. It says that in the 8th year, I promise you, you'll have more than enough to eat till the end of the 8th year. How could any human being promise that? First time they keep Shemitah, we're starving. We're not going to keep this Torah anymore. Goodbye. Correct? Right? And the person who wrote the Torah, if it's a person, he's very smart. He wouldn't make such a stupid mistake. I'll give you another stupid mistake. It says that all the Jewish people, the last source on the page, 3 times a year should come to the Beis HaMikdash. Now, if every Jew in Israel came to Yerushalayim 3 times a year, what would happen?
Traffic jam.
Now, besides the traffic jam.
Where would everybody sleep?
There was plenty of place to sleep. Miracles were made. Remember, this is the Beis HaMikdash, miracles, etc. Well, what would happen, and I'm talking about every Jew, including everybody in the army.
Everything else becomes empty.
Correct. Hamas would be living in your house by the end of Pesach. Correct? Nobody's guarding the border.
Wait, maybe they'll flee for Pesach.
So look what God says.
Burn it down.
Source number 9. Shalosh pamim bashana yerek b'mkor pnei adon Hashem. You have to go. Source number 10. The next pasuk afterwards. Ki yorish goyim mipanecha v'yerchavti et gulecha v'lo yachmod ish et artzecha. I will guarantee you that your land will be protected. V'alof kal erot pnei Hashem when you go up to Yerushalayim. Who could write that in the Torah? Okay, second one. Okay, third thing in the Torah. We all know that kosher animals have 2 symbols, right? Jewish cut and
Klippah.
Right, Jewish cut and has
Klippah.
Okay?
Yeah.
That's very nice. And all animals in the world have either 2, 2, or 0.
Except the
4. Okay? And then the Torah says, except for 4. In the entire world, there are only 4 exceptions. The rabbit, the wolf, some kind of a wolf, the camel, and the pig. Okay? Now, if I were writing the Torah, I would say these are the only 4 exceptions. I haven't been to America. I haven't been to Europe. Right? I'm really in the Middle East. You don't make these. There are 4 exceptions. I don't know how many more there are. But we said, these are the only 4 exceptions, source number 12 says. And 13 says, these are the only 4 exceptions. In the last 3,000 years since the Torah has been given, we have not found 1 exception to the rule of one without the other. Again, nobody would be stupid enough to write the Torah and say these are the only 4 exceptions. Because as soon as they prove them wrong, we got you. Okay. Now, what about the Torah itself? We believe, I believe that the Torah that was given to Moshe Rabbeinu, the written Torah, had to be given with an oral Torah. I think Rav Hirsch says it the best. He says, when you go to a class in college, and you hear the class, and you write down notes, okay, and you 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, you refer to your notes, you can recreate the class based on your notes, correct? Mm-hmm. But if you weren't in the class and you read somebody's notes, they can't understand the Torah. The Torah Sheh B'Ketav is like recreating the notes. So when you have all the people who never got the Torah Sheh Baal Peh reading the Torah Sheh B'Ketav, they can make all kinds of things from it because they weren't there from the thing. How do I know there had to be a Torah Sheh Baal Peh? First of all, source number 14. I'm only going to be 2 minutes, I know we're a little late. It says, Moshe Kibel Torah Mi Sinai. Musar and Yoshua gave it to Yoshua, Yeshua's Canaan's gave him the Vim, etc., etc., etc. How do I know this had to be talking about the Torah Shabbat Peh? The oral Torah, not the written Torah. Because the written Torah wasn't given to Yoshua. Each tribe got its own copy. It says so in the Torah, right? Moshe wrote 13 copies. And each tribe got its own copy. So when it says Moshe got the Torah from God and gave it to Yoshua, one person in each generation was the safeguard of the Torah Shabbat Peh until they couldn't safeguard it anymore, they had to write it down. Everybody understand that? So that's what it means, Torah Shabbat Peh. How do we know there had to be a Torah Shabbat Peh? So I'm going to show you 3 different, again, arguments, not proofs. So the first one is source number 15. It says, When they go into the land of Israel, God, you build the Beit HaMikdash, you have to shecht the animals, like I have commanded you previously. There's no place else in the Torah where God commanded anything about shechting animals in the Beit HaMikdash, not in the Beit HaMikdash. So the fact that he says that you should do it like I commanded you previously, how to be oral. Okay, that's one understanding. I'm going to go skip to 17, then I'll go back to 16. 17. Jewish people, according to our Medrash, the Torah was given on a Thursday. Okay? In the Torah, but we know that some of it was Shabbat, was given beforehand, because it says Shem Sam Chok Mishpat, they gave them some of Shabbat, we know they couldn't carry it, etc. But God says in the Aseret HaDibrot, on the seventh day, you should not do all forms of Malacha, Kol Malacha. Okay, Thursday comes along, people go, wow, God spoke to us, fine. They wake up Friday, they eat their Omer, and they take a double portion. Comes Friday night, what do you think is going to happen? I say, what did God mean when he said this Kol Malacha business? Don't you think you're going to ask Moshe, what did God mean? What do we have to do? We have to keep Shabbat now. What does that mean? Where does it say what they have to do? There were tens of thousands of laws about Shabbat that Moshe had to explain to them, or else how could they keep Shabbat? Okay? So there had to be an explanation. It's not enough to just say, don't do any malacha. You decide for yourselves. What's malacha? How do we do it? What do we keep? Whatever. You know? So by definition, there had to be this, or there's so many gaps in the written Torah that there had to be explanations orally. Was it a formal, not formal? That's irrelevant. There had to be an oral Torah. And I use the source 16 as an example. It says, all it says in the Torah, it says, Ukshatem li'ot al yadkar u'totofot le'inecha. You should tie a symbol on your arm and a totafot, which is not even a Hebrew word, between your eyes. Okay? Nobody says it has to be tefillin. Nobody says it has to be four parshas. Nobody says it has to be, which parshas, how do you make it, where does the tefillin come from? And nobody says it has to be black. And yet, in the history of the Jewish people, nobody ever wore green tefillin. Now, if there were arguments, and later on there are arguments but how could it be that everybody knew exactly? Now, there are differentiations in the minutiae, which got lost, or they had a it was a machloket. But the basic pick doesn't say anything about tefillin here. Doesn't say anything. It says you put a sign on your arm. Sign on my arm could be a swastika, right? Where does it get scraps and this and that? Where did it come from? And yet, we don't see that there was any difference of opinion about tefillin. Even on Sephardim, even Ashkenazim, and there's Rashi tefillin, it's basically the same thing. How could it be the same thing unless there was a tremendous amount of oral Torah that was given at the same time where everybody accepted, everybody knew what to do, and then it was passed on. So therefore, just to summarize, okay, nobody can prove that God exists, but if I had to use Susan's thing, bet one way or the other, based on logic, it makes more sense to think that there is a God than there's not a God. And number two, it makes more sense to feel that the Torah was God-given than it's not God-given, because there are too many mistakes, if you will, if God, the Torah was given. And I'll tell you something else. If you know how Jews work, right? If the Torah was given by a bunch, put together by a committee of people, right? There will be inevitably somebody who says after a few hundred years, my grandfather was in the room, it's all baloney. Right? Somebody should have said, this never happened. God spoke to 3 million people. It's unbelievable. And yet the whole world seemed to accept it. Nobody challenges that. It doesn't make sense unless it happened. Right? And what happened there, I don't know exactly, whatever. But certainly if it was made up by man, certainly Jews would come together and say, no. That can't be true. Or I have a tradition that the Torah wasn't really given by God. Nobody, we never have that at any point. And we have our Masorah that goes from generation to generation to generation of people who did keep. So it's not like we have a gap. We know what happened. in every generation, more or less. But we don't know, you don't know every detail. So, I hope you're a little more enlightened now than you were before.
Yes.
Next week we're going to talk about the Haggadah. Please bring a Haggadah, okay? And I'll try to have for those people who don't, but I won't serve. If you're going to bring a Haggadah, don't even eat a cake outside.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do you have any copies of your book?
Excuse me?
Do you have any copies of your book?
Outside.
How are you doing?